Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So I ask permission from the Sangha, lay community, to say a few words on Dhamma this evening. There's a lot of different contemplations, reflections, a lot of ways to think about the Dhamma, approach the Dhamma. Seems like a lot of people here in the U.S. are interested, like, what is enlightenment? What is Nibbana? Nirvana? I think enlightenment is just an incredibly hackneyed term these days. It's just incredibly misunderstood. This tends to be something we try to conceptualize. Or like, we talk about the knowing. People ask, like, what is the knowing? Wanting it to be some sort of like object. And the knowing is just the knowing. That's all it is. Its function is to know. It's the one who knows. So it's not like, you can't say it's like this object. Or like when I first started practicing and I heard Longpa Sumedho talk about the knowing, I used to try to meditate with different like images in my mind, like either a Buddha, trying to make it stable in the mind, or I decided to try to like put a mirror, like meditate on a mirror, and maybe like the knowing would appear in that mirror. And what I found was like the conceptual mind is just kind of grasping it. It could never, there's no knowing in that mirror. Just the conceptual mind is jumping, trying to grasp at just ideas, concepts. And we can only think about, we can only proliferate about Nibbana, the knowing, enlightenment for so long before we just feel sad and dejected and like, what's the point? So it's just, really what's important is just coming back to the practice, coming back into the here and now Dhamma, the Pachupana Dhamma. And it's like taking these basic aspects of like ordinary, banal aspects of existence, like that's the Dhamma that we take as for our reflection, because we are the living Dhamma. And so this, the six sense bases, that's us. That's the eye sense base, the ear sense base, eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind. These are the six sense bases. And so the eye, and then there's the object of the eye sense base. That's the eye and visible forms. Then there's the ear and sounds, the nose and smells, the tongue and taste sensations, the body and like physical tactile sensations, pain, pleasure. There's the mind and mental objects, thoughts. And there's the eye and sights. And when we're alive, we're imbued with consciousness. All six sense bases are imbued with consciousness, vijnana. If we think in terms of the five khandhas, consciousness is the fifth khandha. This is the consciousness we're talking about, sense consciousness. So the six sense bases are imbued with this consciousness. And that's an aspect, partly an aspect of being alive. But a corpse doesn't have that consciousness. And so the eye visible forms, eye consciousness, meeting of the three is eye contact. The ear, sounds, ear consciousness, meeting of the three we call ear contact. And then the nose, smells, nose consciousness, meeting of the three we call nose contact. The tongue, tastes, tongue consciousness, the meeting of the three is called tongue contact. There's the body, there's touch, there's body consciousness, the meeting of the three is known as body contact. There's the mind, there's mental objects, thoughts, there's mind consciousness, and the meeting of the three is mental contact. And so this contact is what we're talking about as pasa, independent origination. And this contact is a precursor to feeling. And so this contact is very important. It's like the six sense bases have this electrical line called contact, and it's hooked into the heart, and it's like sending dukkha. It's like sending dukkha into the heart, shocking the heart all the time with dukkha, with the dissatisfaction. Because these six sense bases, these are the, and this contact coming from these six sense bases, this is what is giving rise to feeling, painful feeling, pleasant feeling, neither painful nor pleasant feeling. And then from feeling, tanha, craving. And so this is our life. This is our entirety of experience is this. And it's just this in different combinations. It's just feeling. It's just different amplitudes of feeling. And then there's the craving that arises based on that feeling, the craving to make unpleasant feeling disappear, the craving to make pleasant feeling stay with us, and then with neither pleasant nor painful feeling, the craving to feel something painful or pleasant, just anything other than this neutral, boring feeling, which is usually what we feel. Anything other than this mediocrity. Want something exciting or some sort of just something. So there's tanha. Tanha, craving, arises from feeling. Then there's upadana, which is clinging. This is a very important and I think largely misunderstood link, independent origination. Because we focus so much on craving, tanha, desire, comes up in the second noble truth. Tanha is the word used. But there's this very important clinging which follows after it. And the Kruba Ajahns talk about it as like, this is very important, clinging to the craving. There's a clinging to the craving. There's like clinging to greed. There's clinging to anger. There's clinging to delusion. And so it's like we're taking it. We're going into it. We're following it. So there's that clinging to the craving. So it's a big debate in Buddhism. Many Buddhist circles also. It's like, where can you cut the link of dependent origination between contact and feeling, between feeling and craving, between craving and clinging? Most would say it's between feeling and craving. But also there's this very important link, craving and clinging. And Lungpo Cha and other Kruba Ajahns would say, like, you know, they would ask, like, do you have anger? And Ajahn Chah would say, like, yeah, I have anger, but I don't pick it up. I don't use it. Or, like, does greed arise? Yeah, greed arises, but I don't cling to it. It's there as a phenomena in the mind, but I don't cling to it. Ajahn Mun, yeah. I think it was a story where somebody said, like, you know, practice should be easy for you, you know, you don't have any emotions. You don't have any emotions. And Ajahn Mun said, like, that's ridiculous, yeah. I have fear, I have craving, I have desire, I have anger, I have all these things, but I don't cling to them. And that's how he answered the question, or that's how he answered that comment. He said, why is that? It's because I have a heart, you know, just like you. If I didn't have any emotions, that means I don't have a heart. That means I'm a corpse, a dead person. I don't have consciousness. I don't have feeling. So these are just natural phenomena. It's what we call Dhamma Niyamata, which is the naturalness of the Dhamma, the ordinariness of the Dhamma. But there's also Dhamma Titata, which is like the fixed law of the Dhamma. The Dhamma is very exact. There is a way things work. There is a way suffering arises. There is a way suffering ceases. There's a way happiness arises. And it's possible. The Buddha wouldn't teach if it wasn't possible. Kripajans wouldn't teach if it wasn't possible. You know, these great beings constantly exhorting us to goodness because insight into these things is possible. So there's these six sense bases, and that's the Dhamma Niyamata, that's the ordinariness of the Dhamma. And those six sense bases are also Dhamma Titata, they're a fixed mode. And the six sense bases with contact, together with contact, feeling, craving, clinging. So that kind of like general teaching, knowledge of the Dhamma, it's kind of amazing that the Buddha discovered it on his own. No one had to tell him. And he chose to defy the Dhamma, the ordinary Dhamma, in this way, six sense bases. And because of that contact, that's why we have the fire sermon. The Buddha uses the six sense bases as the mode of delivery in the fire sermon. And because of contact, those six sense bases are burning. They're not cool, they're burning. Nibbana literally means cool. And so they're not, these six sense bases are not Nibbana. They're burning. They're burning with what? Burning with the fires of greed, hatred, and delusion. Burning with fires of birth, aging, sickness, and death. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. You know, burning with the fires of suffering. You know, all the sadness, all the pain, dejection we experience is because of those six sense bases. There's a really interesting sutta where the Buddha talks about how he's been to this heavenly realm, and the heavenly realm is called the six sense bases. And in this heavenly realm, he's experienced the six sense bases and only the pleasant through the six sense bases. That's what we know. It's like in the Tibetan tradition, they would call it the pinnacle of samsara. But also, in that same sutta, the Buddha goes on, he says he's been to this hell. He's been down to this hell. And this hell is called the six sense bases. And in this particular hell, he experienced only the unpleasant, the bottom of samsara. And so these are all, this heaven and hell, which we can experience through the six sense bases, it's all of the same nature. It's like another story of Ajahn Mun coming to mind is somebody asked him something like, you know, isn't heaven better than Nibbana? You know, why would you want to? Nibbana is like, you know, this idea of Nibbana is like very lonely and cold, you know, cold, and you're just alone. And people have this idea, you know, isn't heaven better? And Ajahn Mun said, like, you can't even compare heaven with Nibbana. Yeah, you can't even compare. He said, you could say Nibbana's better, but even better doesn't do it justice. So it's like, how do we get out of this like bind that we're in? That's the Dhamma practice. That's like the heart of the practice. And that's the teaching of all the great traditions through history is how do we get out? How do we get out of samsara? How do we get to this vague goal we call Nibbana or enlightenment? And so there's the practice. We've got 22,000 pages of suttas we can read if we want. And we've got the teachings of the Kruba Ajahns all pointing towards the same thing. And I like to recollect like the contemplating the benefit, the drawback, and the escape. And so this is a very interesting teaching in that the Buddha in his 6 years as an ascetic, as a wanderer, before deciding to go off on his own, he studied with a couple different teachers. Under these teachers, he attained highly exalted states of samadhi. I believe under Alarakalama, he attained the formless jhana of nothingness. And under his teacher, Uddaka Ramaputta, he attained to the formless jhana called neither perception nor non-perception. So a state so subtle that there is a type of perception, but you can't say it's perception or non-perception. And still, he found even those highly exalted states, when he exited from them, he saw that that state was still impermanent, that state was still unsatisfactory, that state was still not an end to suffering, even though these other teachers consider that to be full enlightenment. So the Buddha set off on his own and performed extremely severe austerities, eventually saw that it's not a matter of the body either. And then, finding this mental balance, mental equipoise, remembering when he was a child, there was a harvest festival and he was experiencing what we call nibbida, or like world weariness. He wasn't into it. He wasn't happy being, he couldn't join in with the festivities. He wasn't all the merry people merrymaking. He just wasn't into it. And something with him was desires of solitude as a child. And he went and sat under a rose apple tree and had entered into the first jhana at that time. But he remembered that meditation came about very naturally through a world weariness and a desire for solitude. And it came about based on solitude. The first jhana came about based on solitude. So just having that memory, something in him, some intuitive sense said, yeah, that's the direction to go in. Let's investigate that. Let's just practice in a very natural way. In the course of his meditations under the Bodhi tree, then the Buddha started to reflect on the benefits or the gratification of desire or the gratification of pleasant sense objects coming one's way. The gratification is that they're gratifying, that they give some sense of pleasure. Say, good food, it gratifies. That's the gratification. There's some sort of pleasure there. The drawback is that it's impermanent. The drawback is that gratification doesn't last. That's also not just the drawback, but the Buddha referring to it as the danger. The gratification is that it's good, it's sweet. The danger is it's impermanent. And then discerning the escape, complete relinquishment for craving for those sense objects. This is very subtle because the mind, or you could even say the spirit, is completely habituated to acting from desire. So it could be on a coarse or refined level. You know, if we're meditating, the desires might be a bit more refined. They're playing themselves out in the mind in terms of thoughts. So very difficult, very subtle, I think, to discern that escape for a complete abandonment, complete relinquishment. Yeah, that the word is patinisaga. Ajahn Buddhadasa would translate that as a complete giving back. So it's like everything you cling to, it's like it was never yours to begin with, but you were, because of ignorance, you were taking it as yours, so you're giving it back, you're giving it back to nature. And it's just this incredible burden is lifted, there's an incredible lightness. So it's like there's that gratification and the danger and the escape, and it's discerning that escape. But that just comes through investigation of these very. The Buddha came to that through investigating very ordinary things: the breath, the body, the mind, the experience. You know, what's actually happening in the experience? Yeah, the knowing is and mindfulness. Mindfulness together with the knowing, it's like purifying the mindfulness through the practice. So the mindfulness at first is impure. The mindfulness is being colored by our perceptions, colored by our memories, colored by our personality. And through the meditation, the mindfulness becomes more and more purified. So it's a purification of mindfulness, a cleaning out of the mindfulness. This comes about through holding precepts, through meditating, through doing the contemplation. And so it's like sati sampajanya, as the mindfulness gets purified, it's like seeing more and more clearly, and that's the knowing being allowed to function more and more clearly. It's not really saying like what is the knowing, but it's like as the mind becomes more calm and more settled, it's like allowing the knowing to shine through more truly. And in an unbiased way, not colored by perceptions, not colored by different thoughts and desires that are passing by in the mind. And discernment, discerning the experience. So coming back to the sixth sense bases, I think a really important point too in understanding these sixth sense bases is as the last sense base, there's the mind and mind objects. I think this is very important that this is grouped together with the other five sense bases, because so often if we're thinking like we want to lead a spiritual life, lead a life of contemplation, meditation, we might have this idea that there's some sort of like, you know, all is one or higher self that we're going to be attaining. But the Dhamma is ordinary, so it's going into and through these ordinary experiences. So the mind is of exactly the same nature as the other five sense bases. So I think that's very important for understanding the nature of thought, because so often we give way too much importance to our thoughts. You know, if a bad thought, I'm a bad person, we identify with it right away. If a good thought, like, you know, oh, I have a good idea, my idea, you know, it's just like we identify so quickly with the thoughts and it happens so fast. But just knowing that thought is of the exact same nature as, say, like a visual object. So it's like, if I look at that Buddha Rupa in the corner, that Buddha Rupa is like a thought. So, you know, if I want that Buddha Rupa to go away, I can just close my eyes. So that's like going into samadhi. You're making the thought disappear temporarily. But the thoughts are just there. They're just natural phenomenon coming and going. So it's like, if you think, if thought is seen in that nature, it kind of changes it. You know, it's just like seeing a tree outside. Say it's like an ugly tree. I want to get rid of that tree. A bad thought comes up. I want to get rid of that thought. So you can put forth a lot of effort and go and get the chainsaw and rev it up and cut the tree down, and you can put forth a lot of effort and grit your teeth and force that thought to go away, you know, push it down, repress it. But it's the same thing. It's just a thought. It doesn't matter if it's a good thought or a demented thought. What's important is we're not clinging to it and acting on it. That's the coming back to the sila, the protection. The protection of our precepts, of our virtue, gives us an idea like, no, we don't want to act on a thought of killing. You know, we might have a thought like, I want to harm this other person, but we don't act on it. That's not to say we don't do practices to steer our thoughts in a certain direction. Like the Buddha spoke in praise of becoming a master of thought. But at the same time, it's good to know the nature of it. We can't just suddenly think completely different thoughts than what habitually arises in our mind on a daily basis. But we can steer it in a certain direction. So it's like if a floor in a room is, you know, it visually it's dirty, we can put forth some effort and we can grab the mop and we can mop the room and then it looks clean, it's pleasing. So if some sort of, say, like a thoughts of anger are habitually arising, yeah, we can contemplate loving kindness. That's like grabbing the mop and cleaning the floor. And we should do that because thoughts of anger are a hindrance to meditation. Thoughts of lust are a hindrance to meditation. You know, just the energy of sloth and torpor or restlessness or doubt, these are hindrances to settling, to meditation. So we do have practices. We do have practices for steering the thought in a certain direction, steering the thought in a skillful direction. And if we don't put forth that kind of effort of purifying ourselves and steering the thoughts in the correct direction, away from sensuality, away from thoughts of cruelty, away from thoughts of harming, you know, we're going to be moving towards sensuality, towards thoughts of harming, towards thoughts of cruelty. So that's leading away from the practice. We can think of the practice like it's leading towards heaven, but it goes beyond heaven. So we want, you know, we need that basis of happiness. We need contentment. We need a certain level of contentment to keep going. So cultivating thoughts of loving kindness and compassion, letting go of sensuality, this is a cultivation of contentment and more refined levels of happiness. The practice of meditation on a daily basis, the keeping of precepts, this leads to a very deeply rooted contentment. But at the same time, the reason for that contentment is to see the true nature of these things, to see the true nature of these thoughts. That a good or a bad thought is just as empty as a beautiful or an unbeautiful tree outside. So at a certain point, we decide to let go. You know, we don't need to identify with these thoughts. We don't need to cling to them, push them away, grab onto them, run after them. I remember at Wat Pa Pong, we would have these like evening massage and Dhamma discussion sessions with Longpo Liam at Wat Pa Pong, and he's kind of like, he's been doing duties in the monastery, so you know, the attendants and others are kind of around like massaging the feet, the hands. He's got a lot of like back and shoulder pain, so somebody's massaging the back, and he'll just start talking about some sort of whatever Dhamma pops into his mind. And I remember being really moved one time when he was saying like, thought is actually really powerful. The mind is actually just so incredibly changeable. It's like you can have some sort of reflection going and be completely in heaven. And you can be like really content and happy. And then someone can walk by and just make one comment about you, one criticism, and you can be in tears within a second. And he's saying that's how powerful the mind is. And so these thoughts are not to be taken lightly, you know. The body and mind are so interwoven that just one thought arising can change the entire body chemistry within a second. That's pretty powerful. Yeah, so I think it's just good to recollect that that the practice is just very ordinary. It's good probably not to get too focused on like what is Nibbana, what is enlightenment. Just coming back to a basic investigation and a cultivation of contentment. But also remembering that what we're here for, if we're really like, say, planting the seeds, so it's like keeping that determination in the back of the mind, like planting the seeds of Bodhi. Because these ordinary contemplations, that's what it's doing. We're like sowing these seeds, you know, tilling the fields. That's what it means to cultivate. That's why I kind of like the word cultivation better than like practice. It's cultivation. It's like something's happening, something's growing inside. I think that's enough for this evening. It's been a work day, so I'll just end the talk there. Annamayam Bhagavataya Sadhukaram Dadamaste.